From the studios at Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. 100 million people in the United States could get COVID this fall and winter. That's according to the Biden administration, which is warning of new Omicron subvariants. And the Washington Post reports that we're approaching 1 million deaths from COVID all across our country. So here today to talk about these statistics, along with other coronavirus news, as well as your questions, is Dr. David Pate. He is former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. I want to welcome you back to the program, Dr. Pate.
Thank you, Gemma. Good to be with you.
And remember, folks, if you have a question, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Okay, Dr. Pate, I want to talk about the possibility of 100 million new coronavirus cases this fall and winter. So what's driving that prediction?
Well, you know, there's various modeling going on. And of course, to do modeling, you have to make certain assumptions. And so what I've long said on this show with you, Gemma, is whenever people start asking me about new variants, what I say is we have to look at two different sets of behaviors to understand what the risk is. What are the behaviors of the virus and what are the behaviors of the hosts, us, people? Because that is what's going to determine what the magnitude of the problem is going to be. So some factors that lead to this prediction are, number one, we've had a big surge every winter. Now, don't confuse that with seasonality. I still hear experts talking about seasonality. The only seasonality to this virus, if there is that it occurs in all seasons. But historically, during the winter months, whether it's people gathering for holidays, people traveling for holidays, cold and people coming indoors, whatever it is, we always have seen a big surge before, so it's a pretty good bet we'll have another one. The second thing is this behavior of viruses. What are we seeing? What we are seeing in the progression, if you go back to the original virus to D614G, which we had in 2020, and then 2021, we started with alpha and beta and gamma and then we got to Delta. And then now, most recently, our most recent surge was with one of the sublineages of Omicron, the BA1 or BA11. And so now what we're seeing is new sublineages of Omicron. And I'm sure we'll talk about those. But what you see when you look at the overall pattern is what we refer to is fitness advantage. In other words, what gives one variant an advantage over another? Because we've seen two variants be present at the same time and one will outpace the other. Whatever that factor is that allows it to outpace, that's what we call a fitness advantage. Now, up until BA1, which is the one that we just had our surge with, every one of those, the advantage they had was more transmissibility. With BA1, that got a big boost from immune escape, something that we've been concerned about from the beginning of 2021. And so we're seeing it. What we've seen since BA1, now that we're dealing with BA2, BA2.12.1, is we've seen a return to more transmissibility, about 25% more transmissible than even what we were dealing with before, which was highly transmissible. Now, with BA4 and BA5 that we're seeing in South Africa and a number of other countries now, it looks like a big increase in immune escape again. So the behavior of the virus would predict that we are going to have problems in the future because not enough people vaccinated, not enough people with protection from infection. So that's a factor. Then you look at the host behavior, people behavior. Well, what's different? Mm-hmm. What's different is we're through with masks. We're through with restricting large gatherings. We're through with worrying about the protections in public transportation for the large part. And so what you would say if you're predicting is, well, if you do that, then you'll have more transmission of virus. So all of those factors come together to suggest we're going to have a big wave in the fall. There, I think 100 million is kind of on the outside of the high range. But take this one point as a sobering thought. Let's say that the case fatality rate remains basically what we've seen starting at the, you know, beginning of this virus, about 1% of people that would die. If it's true that we're going to see 100 million cases, and if the CFR, the case fatality rate, is going to be 1%, doing some advanced calculus, that tells you that we'll have a million deaths. We just got to a million deaths now in 2 years. Now we're talking about in the fall, we could have another million deaths. Let that sink in for a few minutes.
And Dr. Pate, if I'm understanding this right, a lot of this has to do with these new Omicron subvariants that you mentioned, because they are overcoming our immunity, correct?
Yes, to some degree. Now I will tell you that I'm not sure what we're going to be dealing with in the fall. Frankly, the variants that we know about today, I suspect we'll be dealing with them in the upcoming days, weeks, and months. And I suspect it'll be something new this fall. Now, if you ask the question, well, what would we likely be dealing with? I think a lot of people would say it appears that it will continue being sublineages of Omicron. Now, that would be a good thing in my mind if it is, because now we already have, Moderna has already developed what they call a bivalent vaccine, meaning that it has the spike protein of the ancestral or original virus, but they've also added the spike with all those 30-some mutations from the Omicron. And so, and an early study looks like that combination may give us a better immune response and a longer one. So, and they think they'll have that ready for this fall. So if we are going to continue seeing variations on the Omicron theme, this may be good news. The reason I hedge, and I'm not willing to commit and say that's definitely what's going to happen, is this virus is in a lot of what we call reservoirs. That is, places that the virus can hide out and we don't know about it. And so, for example, I could give you a long list of animals that this virus infects and that are infected, including things like deer that are here in the United States, many other animals as well. And what can happen is in other animals, this virus can mutate even more. And what we have now recently seen is that there are at least a couple of species of animals that are able to transmit that virus back to humans so that we could pick up new mutations we haven't even thought about. So that's one thought. The other is, as you know, and we've lamented on this show, is that we've really taken a cavalier approach to protecting the immunocompromised. And of course, a lot of that's been selfish because we want to get on with our lives and we're kind of like, you know, tough luck for you if you're immunocompromised. But as I've mentioned before, it's a bit short-sighted. And the reason it is it should be in all of our interests to protect the immunocompromised from getting infected. Why? Because they actually, because their immune system can't clear the virus effectively in all cases, they may harbor that virus I think the longest one we've got documented now is 50 some months that somebody remained infected.
Wow.
In another country that was immunocompromised. During that time, what we are doing is we're saying, okay, virus, here you go. Here's a human laboratory. You just keep practicing making mutations in that person's body and see what works the best. And then that immunocompromised person can, after that virus has made a lot of mutations, can now come back into the population that's not immunocompromised. And we may be dealing with very different variants. I don't know. We're just going to have to continue to monitor this. But all of this tells me is we're not learning the lesson that the only motivator to controlling this disease should not be fear of death or hospitalization. The fear should be that if we don't control the transmission, this will continue to mutate. And the virus selects for more transmissible, more immune evasive strains. And that's what we're all going to be dealing with. Not to mention the risks of long COVID and other health effects that we are only starting to understand and see the magnitude of. So I think we've been quite short-sighted. I do think it's likely we're going to have a winter surge. I think we're going to have a surge before the winter. But I think it could be a big one. I hope not. And I hope we learn and we all take steps to prevent that. But if it continues that we're not going to learn the lessons, then yes, we're probably going to get another lesson in virology.
Dr. Pate, I want to talk about something that that we're starting to see here in the Treasure Valley. And this is our test positivity rates. What's going on with that right now?
Yeah, we are seeing the very beginnings of an increase. How big of an increase, I can't tell you at this point, but we are seeing we're seeing increasing cases. We're seeing increasing testing positivity. We're seeing the very beginnings of some increased hospitalizations. We're not seeing increased deaths at this point and wouldn't expect to. What we can say is that certainly while still low in the state of Idaho, and certainly many more states in our country that are having much higher levels of transmission than we are increasing. We see it in our testing positivity, and I've checked with the hospitals, urgent care, the state. We're seeing that increase everywhere. We're seeing it in the city of Boise wastewater, just a little blip of starting to go up. So all signs are that cases are increasing here. How high that will go is unknown, but I think what we have to consider in our state is that we have a lower rate of vaccination than many other states. And in other states that have higher levels of vaccination and also presumably infections, because some of these states have been in some pretty major waves that we have been a bit spared from, they're seeing cases go way up. So I think we should be prepared for those who are at higher risk, for those that live with someone at higher risk, for those that are immunocompromised, for those that don't want to take a chance of getting long COVID. This would be the time to start increasing your precautions. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about that, Dr. Pate, when we say increasing our precautions. I mean, should we be going back to masking indoors, even if, let's say, we're fully vaccinated, we're fully boosted? I think that that's where some of the confusion lies, is it almost feels like it did almost 2 years ago, where it's like, well, what am I supposed to do? Or I've been doing all the right things, so what am I supposed to do now?
Yeah, and Jim, it's a very appropriate question because, frankly, our own CDC has horribly confused this issue for the public, I think. So let me tell you how I think about this. So I don't think this is, I'm not advocating for mandates. I'm not, advocating for any of that. I'm just telling you about how would I advise people to make your own decisions. And so if you're someone in the categories that I mentioned who doesn't want to get infected for any of a number of reasons, then what you need to do is consider that the risks of you getting infected have now increased and they appear to be on an upswing. So what does that mean to you? Well, it means that this virus is predominantly spread through aerosols. It's predominantly spread through particles of fluid containing the virus that are very small that can travel on air streams. And if you're close enough to the person, it can travel by what we've long talked about, these respiratory droplets. But if you're outdoors, then these air streams are not very applicable. And so really outdoors, all you have to worry about is respiratory droplet. That's where we have that 6-foot rule. That's where we talk about you have to be close to somebody to get that. And outside, you probably do. Now, so an outside activity, what you'd want to consider is, am I going to the park with my kids and we're running around? Or am I going outside to a rally, a concert, or a sporting event where we're going to be shoulder to shoulder? If it's the latter, you can definitely get infected outdoors like that. If you're going to go to the park and you're going to be running around and you're not in that shoulder to shoulder group, you're not going to have much risk of getting infected. So no, you don't need to wear a mask if you're going to do like that. If you're going to go to the rally, concert, sporting event and be packed shoulder to shoulder, I would sure wear a mask. Now, indoors, what's the difference? The difference in indoors is that indoor facilities have HVAC systems, ventilation systems that heat or cool the air. And so what you'll see in a room is there is a inlet for the air where it comes in, and then there is an air return. And you see these in your rooms, your house and so forth, where the air goes up into to be returned. That's the stream going from where it comes into the room to where it goes out. That's the stream that can carry this virus. And it doesn't matter how big that room is if it's carried by that same airstream as somebody who's infected. So you know, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the Gridiron Dinner, all you have to do is be in the same big room that is got the same air circulation system and you can be at risk. So what do you do? Well, one thing is if you know the facility you're going to be in has really good air handling, so they're doing a lot of air exchanges every hour, they circulate the air out of the building instead of recirculating the air, or if they do recirculate the air, they use HEPA filters or other filters that will kill the air, or they have UV light devices to kill the virus, then those are much safer environments. Few of the places you're going to go to will have that. So what I do, and since I generally don't know how good the air handling is at facilities, when I go indoors, that's the time to mask. Now, what about masking? Well, the keys to masking, because we are dealing with a completely much more transmissible virus today than what we were back in 2020 and even 2021, you've got to have a higher quality mask. Wearing a cloth mask, wearing a surgical mask, that's not going to do it. You need a KN95, N95, N100, P100. You need a high grade mask. And the other thing is it has to fit very well to your face. If it leaves gaps, and that's the problem with surgical masks, is there's almost always little gaps around that, mm-hmm. then these aerosols can get in there. So that's the key for right now.
We are getting all kinds of questions in. So I want to get to Mark's question. He sent this in and he says, what is the definition of immunocompromised? I'm 64 years old. I'm in good health. When I'm trying to schedule my second booster shot through the St. Luke's Health app, it asks if I'm immunocompromised. If I say no, the app tells me I cannot schedule a booster shot.
Yeah, so he is eligible for a shot. It's just I don't believe that St. Luke's is doing that. The last time I checked, and I tried to get my second booster at St. Luke's, and I couldn't, so I went elsewhere and got it. So he can get the second booster. He's eligible for it. He just may not be able to get it there. But to answer his question, what is immunocompromised? Immunocompromised is any condition, health condition you have, or medication that you're taking that would impair the ability of your body to fight infection. So examples are many types of cancers themselves are immunocompromising. If you have, for example, blood cancers would be the most well-known example. They are going to impair your ability to fight off infection. The treatments we give people for cancer often, not always, but often are ones that will further impair and cause immunocompromise. People that have had organ transplants and now they have to take medicine to suppress their immune system so their body won't reject the organ, they're immunocompromised. There are people with autoimmune diseases that their body cannot respond appropriately to an infection, they are immunocompromised. And then another big group is people that have immune deficiencies. In other words, they are born with or acquired a condition where they don't make all the antibodies or some antibodies that normal people do, or they have problems with other kinds of their cells that fight infection that don't work or they don't have them.
Okay. Dr. Pate, Penelope in Haley wants to know more about a study in Australia of children who had severe responses to COVID, which is often called MISC. So what do we know about this study?
So this study she's referring to used a new field of study that we have called proteomics, which looks at the spectrum of proteins in our bodies and what roles they may play in disease. And what they did is they looked at some kids that just got severely ill and had the respiratory failure that people have those images of people in the ICU on ventilators. And then they looked at also a group of kids that got the condition you mentioned, the MISC, which is the multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children, that makes them critically ill, often several months after their infection. And then they compared the proteins that they found in those children to what proteins are normally present in healthy kids. And they took blood from kids even before the pandemic to know that those kids had not been exposed to the virus. And what they found is that there was, in each of those groups, there was more than 50 different proteins that shouldn't have been there or shouldn't have been in those levels. Now, what that does is that just actually leads to some more studies we need to do, because abnormal proteins can be there a couple of different reasons. One is they may be playing a role in causing the disease. And obviously that's the intention. Let's identify what proteins may be playing a role in causing the disease, because we may be able to direct therapies specifically against that. But you also have to sort out which proteins are there because of the damage. So for example, when you damage a cell, that will release proteins into the blood. And so we want to make sure that we're seeing which of those proteins are actually the ones that are causative, not just evidence of what's going on. So very good study to help try to advance our understanding of why these kids are getting this ill, but no firm answers yet.
Mm-hmm. This listener just wrote in and says, is a second booster necessary right now if we will need another booster this fall?
Well, it's not necessary in the sense that it is not an official recommendation that people get a second booster here in the United States. What the FDA has said is that if you're over 50, and especially if you feel that you or your doctor feels that you are at increased risk, you may get a second booster. Now, my own view on this is that the data is limited because this is evolving. It's probably most clear for those that are over 60. And probably if you're over 60 and you do have some underlying medical conditions, which many do, or you have specific concerns, it certainly, we know it's safe to get the second booster. And it actually might be a good idea to get it now because we're getting ready to face, I think, at least there's a good chance we are at the very beginning of a surge right now, or we may still have another one before this winter. By this fall, I think we will have different vaccines. And so the fact that you get a second booster now is not going to preclude you from getting that different vaccine in the fall. But if you wait till the fall, the data would suggest you will have some slight increased risk due to the waning of the vaccine, but you still have pretty good protection. And that's why it's not an official recommendation.
So Dr. Pate, we have about a minute left, but I want to quickly get to this question from Trisha, because her husband's sister-in-law tested positive for COVID yesterday. They were with her on Mother's Day. So this is day three since exposure. Trisha wants to know, if she tests positive, where does she get a PCR test? And should she take those antiviral drugs?
You can be eligible for the antiviral drugs by either doing the rapid test at home, or you can do a rapid test at a healthcare provider, or you can do the PCR test. You don't have to have a PCR test, but if you are going to get a PCR test, you will have to go to a medical provider. Most likely there might be some pharmacies that will do that. And so look at your local healthcare provider's website. They'll have testing places, or go to the state website. They can tell you. Now, if you get a positive test, then the second part of her question is, should she take an antiviral? That depends on her risk, and that depends on what other medications she may be taking. So I can't answer that question. She's going to have, without knowing a lot more information, she's going to have to discuss that with her doctor.
Okay. Well, as always, Dr. Pate, thank you for your time today. We apologize for not getting to all the questions. We will get to them next week. Get them to us if you have them, Idaho Matters, at boisestate.edu. And as always, Dr. Pate, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Gemma.
And we'll have more Idaho Matters coming up next.